program will be a panel on the use of audio archives in contemporary network radio programming. The chairman is Ernest Dick, and I will let him introduce the panel members. Ernie?
Okay, thanks, Tim. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, being one of the finest broadcasting institutions in the world, we thought it would be remiss of us not to take advantage of ARSC coming to Ottawa to expose ARSC members to the CBC. From the earliest days of broadcasting in North America, Canadians realized that unregulated and unfettered free enterprise could not be relied upon to serve Canadian cultural interests. Thus, we have a long history of careful, if also hotly contested, regulation of broadcasting so that specifically Canadian objectives might be met. Similarly, we've had direct involvement of the federal government in network broadcasting as early as 1927, with continuous broadcasting from 1932 on. The CBC itself was founded in 1936, having been preceded for 4 years by the Canadian Radio Broadcasting Commission. The delicate balance between public funding, hence government control, and journalistic and artistic freedom has been preserved with great vigilance. Indeed, the annual right of politicians being offended by the CBC is one of the great Canadian sports enjoyed by and participated in by all. The range of imaginative, entertaining, challenging, and well-crafted radio that the CBC has produced over the years, it's impossible to summarize or illustrate in a few sentences. Those of you who've ever lived close to your northern border, pick up the CBC signal, might have your own favorite examples. We've organized a small sampling for Friday night, when one of the fellow archivists from the Sound Archives will bring some extracts from the golden age of CBC radio drama to our banquet. However, unfortunately, we cannot in Canada boast of a more enlightened or far-sighted archival policy at the CBC. We have exactly what we usually have had with broadcasters. It was only in 1959 that the CBC took its first formal step in acknowledging its responsibility for its archives and appointing Robin Woods to head up a program. Some of you may remember Robin, as he has been active in ARSC and contributed an article in the on the CBC program archives for the ARSC Journal in the spring-summer issue of 1970. It was 1961 before Robin had a magnificent staff of five, and he often described his task as feeling akin with the man to hold back the tide with an old broom. And though the staff has managed to double in the past 20 years, not really a very significant jump, staff and resources remain pitifully inadequate for the job they're attempting to do across a vast country. I think it's five time zones. The CBC program archives are situated in Toronto, where the great majority of network production originates, and a parallel archival program exists in Montreal for the French language network. In very recent years, the federal government has allotted funds to the Public Archives of Canada to establish a national film, television, and sound archives. Thus, we've been able to divide a little bit the monumental archival task before us between the public archives and the CBC, that we might make some progress in preserving and making accessible this magnificent achievement in Canadian broadcasting. Currently, the CBC Program Archives concentrates their effort on selecting, acquiring, and cataloging contemporary broadcasting, while the Sound Archives at the PAC chips away at the mountain of unidentified backlog of soft-cut acetates and early tapes. And given the present resources, it will be a good many years yet before we have a comprehensive picture of what really has survived the ravages of time. In regards to the use of CBC archives, we likewise divide the task. CBC Program Archives serves the internal CBC needs for ongoing programming, and the Public Archives serves more general public access for research. There's always exceptions to that, but that's generally how we divide the work. In the panel this afternoon, we've decided to focus on the use of the CBC Program Archives in continuing broadcasting. Though any one of us can speak to broader issues in terms of selection criteria or cataloging or anything that may interest you. Dido Mendel, on my right, is the selection and research officer with the CBC Program Archives and has been with the Program Archives since 1968. She's one of the most reliable sources on Canadian radio that I know, and she can confirm that I call her often to clarify something I'm unclear on. She will give us a general introduction as to who, how, and how often the CBC program archives is being used for ongoing production. I know they've compiled some very impressive statistics to try to win more staff and resources for the program archives, and to enliven the statistics, she has more than a few harrowing as well as satisfying tales of deadlines they've usually been able to meet. The second speaker on my left is George Jameson. He's a CBC producer with the award-winning program As It Happens, and he's had particular occasion to make use of the CBC program archives. As It Happens is a nightly 90-minute current affairs program broadcast across Canada Network as well as internationally on shortwave. It has developed the call-out format into a new style of radio programming, and you can ask George more about that if you wish. We've asked him here today to tell us about the As It Happened documentaries, which have relied heavily upon historical recordings. These 30-minute programs have been broadcast once a week on Wednesday nights, at least recently, and made particularly imaginative use of sound archives. I might mention this series is by no means the only one in which the CBC makes use of its archive resources. Indeed, point out in our audience today, we have a CBC Ottawa producer, Ken Panier, who produced a series of 13 programs aired last summer under the title For the Record. Maybe you can just stand, Ken, so that people can later ask you any questions. We've asked George to bring some extracts with him and explain what they attempt to do in the As It Happened format. So I'll ask Dido to begin now, and then we'll go to George.
Okay. Well, 35 years ago today, the German army surrendered. It was VE Day all over the Western world. And it was the beginning of the end of World War II. It takes very little imagination to imagine how busy we have been in my department, CBC Program Archives, over the past week or so. In spite of the fact that I do tell producers they've known this anniversary was coming for years, why couldn't we have notice? We almost always get our requests just before it's airtime, almost. The exciting thing about being a broadcasting archivist is that the subject matter we treat is just as vast as broadcasting is itself. I thought I'd say something about the qualities needed in the staff that we have to look after archives. They must have a very, very broad education and some knowledge of broadcasting, but mostly they must have lively, creative imaginations and a lot of curiosity and the instincts of a detective. Forming the department could have been a really dull routine assignment. Instead, basically it's become an inspired service and it enriches most areas of CBC programming life. Our research is growing over the years. The volume, 10 years ago, I guess we were doing about 3 requests for various production centers across Canada a day. Now we are doing supplying between 3 and 6 items for current broadcasting per hour, per working hour, that is, in archives. It's a lot of work. It's rewarding. But as Ernie said, our staff is very small. I'll give you some examples of the type of request we get, anniversary requests, as for VE Day, which the anniversary of it's today. We've supplied material during this last week to Halifax, Montreal, Sudbury, Toronto, and Edmonton for this. I assume that Ottawa got onto you for their lot. And we managed to supply actuality reports from CBC war correspondents leading up to the liberation of Holland. One actuality report which includes the sound of the last shots being fired in the streets of Amsterdam. Then that was followed by actuality of rejoicing in the streets and people singing and dancing and etc. A description, an eyewitness description of the signing of the surrender in Holland and of the German surrender. Overall, celebrations around the world, actuality of the VE Day riots that occurred in Halifax, and so on and so on and so on. makes for much more interesting programming. The other sort of request that is probably the most frequent type that we get is for producers wanting historical background to current news. A prime example of this is the referendum question coming up in Quebec right now. We've been working all out on this for the past 3 or 4 weeks. One producer is doing a documentary just on the Parti Québécois. That's fairly simple. It's November of 1976 to date. Another one, a much more interesting request, has decided to do the history of Quebec. That's from Mackenzie King and the issue over conscription during World War I through the FLQ crisis in 1970, the War Measures Act being declared, the Parti Québécois win and the referendum, etc. It's fun. The other sort we get is nostalgia programming. Most of you would be most interested in that, I would think. I was very interested this morning listening about all the old records, because we have a fair collection ourselves. For that sort of programming, we supply old pop songs, etc., or depending what type of program it is. Newscast, if a producer is doing a program on the flavor of a particular era, he will want not only the popular culture of the day, maybe highlights from the more classical type thing, and also newscasts so that the audience will know what people were going through, etc., in that day. And he'll marry all these together to make a really rounded, fascinating program, one hopes, usually. You can imagine our cataloging demands. In order to make retrieval as rapid as possible, we have to do the most detailed and meticulous cataloging. We couldn't catalog by collection or a sort of broad general way like that. Each separate program is listened to by a research auditioner. An analytical précis is written, and that then goes to the cataloger, who assigns the subject headings and the speaker headings out of that, then goes back and gets index cards and a master card, which is also a shelf list of our collection. As we accession approximately 96 hours of programming every week, and we have 3 people who do all the auditioning and all the research, that is supplying 3 items per working hour to production centers across the country, we do fall behind. However, everything is instantly cataloged by broadcast date and by series title. So you can get it material, provided you do some extra research into when and the title of the program before you come to it. Just to show you how once, have I got time to go on a bit?
Sure.
Just a tiny example of how meticulous the cataloging must be. In a program that was done a few years ago about a Canadian composer called Weinzweig, it was a profile of this man. And during the course of the program, he was talking about his youth in Toronto, etc. And he mentioned that he had been unable to get a visa to the United States because his father had once written a piece called The Red Ear of Corn. Surprisingly enough, about 4 years later, that one little 10-second clip was lifted out of that program and used in a documentary on the 1950s to give point to what life was like during the McCarthy era. And now we've got to that sort of thing. I'll hand over to George, who uses this all the time.
Go ahead, George.
Thanks. Unlike a lot of stuffy librarian types who believe that this would be a great place if all these people would stop coming in and taking the books out of order, our archives are readily accessible, and I assure you that Dido speaks the truth when she says they enjoy pulling this stuff out and giving it back to us because we actually get to make use of it rather than let it collect dust. Our series of retrospective programs was virtually born of the archive system we have. It began as a notion that since the CBC had its beginnings in 1936 and we might be able to resurrect some of the programming from that time, why don't we put together a special, a half hour or an hour of the kind of programming we would have done in 1936, the kind of events we would have covered. By the time we'd actually gone into archives and found out what was there, we discovered there's material on virtually any year and virtually any subject you like. And we decided to pull them out and cobble them together and not stop with 1936, but carry on through every year we could possibly program. We've now covered everything from 36 to 68, and we'll be doing 1969 and 1970 shortly. Fair warning.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you who haven't heard the program, as Ernie mentioned, if you live near the border, you may have heard it. Or if you don't live near the border, but you have a shortwave radio, we do broadcast straight through to the Caribbean. And if you don't, perhaps the closest comparison may be some of the NPR broadcasts, All Things Considered, or their new morning edition. Not identical, but close. This is a sample of the opening of one of our Wednesday night As It Happened documentaries.
As It Happened, 1963, part one. Diefenbaker and Pearson slug it out over the Bomark missile. George Wallace of Alabama squares off against the National Guard. Whimsy still rules the hit parade, but Bob Dylan charts a new music for a new generation. And Martin Luther King leads 200,000 civil rights marchers on Washington. As It Happened, 1963. The world powers weren't about to ban the bomb, but they wanted desperately to control it, thanks to unrestrained nuclear tests in the atmosphere, under the oceans, and in space. The world finally had the tools with which to destroy itself. In an attempt to break a deadlock between the United States and Russia over test ban conditions, John Kennedy took the first step. On June 10th, he announced an end to American atmospheric tests.
It makes no sense in an age when the deadly poisons produced by a nuclear exchange would be carried by wind and water and soil and seed to the far corners of the globe and a generation yet unborn. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future. And we are all mortal.
With the intervention of British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, negotiations were completed in Moscow, and a test ban was agreed upon by the end of July. In September, Radio Moscow announced Soviet ratification of the pact.
The Soviet government considers it a success of the peaceful foreign policy of the Soviet Union, a success of all states advocating the aversion of the danger of a new war and the maintenance and consolidation of peace.
The arms race may have slowed down, but Washington and Moscow had another arena in which to battle for world supremacy.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. We have ignition. 3, 2, 1. We have liftoff.
The space race was big time showbiz, and people got out of bed at any hour of the day or night to watch a televised launch. They got their most dramatic show on June 16, 1963, when the Faith 7 capsule malfunctioned just before re-entry. Astronaut Gordon Cooper had to steer the capsule manually. He risked incineration at 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit if he made a mistake. The world listened as John Glenn aboard the Coastal Sentry Quebec talked Cooper to Earth.
CSU Capcom, all right, you sound good. How's that checklist? All complete?
All complete, equipment for us.
Hi, Roger. How's the window attitude? Check okay?
Roger, right on the old.
That's the way, boy. Just two posts are coming in. Good head.
The Americans played up the space race, giving it all the publicity they could. In contrast, the Russian space program was a well-kept secret. But Moscow knew how to call attention to its triumphs. 1 month after Cooper's flight, Radio Moscow made this announcement.
Exactly at 12:30 Moscow time, the spaceship Vostok 6 was successfully launched into orbit, piloted by a woman, a Soviet citizen, Teresa Kova, TERESHKOVA, Teresa Valentina Vladimirovna.
While Valentina Tereshkova spoke to the world, both Russia and the United States were launching satellite after satellite. The world watched them all. Everything that went into orbit became a star, even the telecommunications satellite Telstar. Hit parade in 1963. Established crooners Andy Williams and Steve Lawrence rubbed elbows with the Chiffons, the Orlons, and a bunch of guys all named Bobby, with haircuts that looked like Orlon and Chiffon. Record buyers were desperate for something new. And while they waited for the next Elvis, they bought novelty songs, making 1963 the year of the offbeat hit. The Singing Nun was the hit of the Ed Sullivan Show and the queen of the charts. Her one album sold well, and she was the subject of a fictionalized movie. But by the end of the year, she was forgotten. Japanese pop star Kyo Sakamoto had his turn at the top, ending up at number four in the year's top 50. And all those parents who complained they couldn't understand a word were finally right. The number one pop single of 1963 was the perfect symbol of the music industry, a combination of mediocrity, restlessness, and a hint of what was to come, turned four clean-cut kids from Seattle into one-hit immortals.
That's the first 6 minutes of that program. It goes on with material from Broadway, some movies. As you heard in the opening, there's an excerpt from the Martin Luther King speech. And we found that the best programs were the ones where we weren't necessarily looking for just the big story or just the important personality of the year. But the oddball stuff, the thing that I guess now sells People magazine. In 20 years, people will be going through back issues of that to summarize the late 70s. And we found that as we got closer and closer to the present, there was, of course, more and more material in the archives. And some of the years we, in fact, split into two portions. 1963 was an example. As you may imagine, there was a lot of material on the JFK assassination. That was a good part of the second version of the program. And in going through the archives, we found that there would be individual topics and individual stories that, for some reason, had generated all kinds of material, and it had all ended up in the archives. Someone would come back in the middle of research into 1950 and 1951 and say, you won't believe how much stuff there is about Joe McCarthy every time you turn around. As a matter of fact, some years that was almost all you could get out of the early 50s was who Joe was mad at and who was mad at Joe. So we decided to take some of those individual topics out and do specials just on them. As examples, we've done a Joe McCarthy piece that I'll play a portion of. We did a piece on Muhammad Ali before his latest comeback. And I believe we started a number that are still in progress on Adolf Eichmann. Gerda Munsinger was a favorite. If you're from outside of the country, we have our very own Elizabeth Ray, except this was 1964 when they called them party girls. And this is a portion of our version of the Joe McCarthy hearings. But there was literally so much on Joe that we had to come down to the Army McCarthy hearings, which were later in the 50s after he had had his day with the Un-American Activities Committee. Although if you've got a keen ear for history, you'll hear little bits and pieces from other years popping in there.
Point of order. Chairman, point of order. Point of order. Chairman, point of order. Point of order. The decline and fall of Senator Joe McCarthy. The Army McCarthy hearings, 1954.
Now you can move away if you like, Stu. You can move away if you like. You have been here trying to smear the staff of this committee. The young men who have been working to uncover communists, you jump up and run away.
Senator Joe McCarthy, once the most feared man in the United States, watches helplessly as his fellow senators deliberately ignore his outbursts.
I have asked you a simple question. Do you have any evidence of any kind to indicate that there is any subversive amongst these young men? If not, you are leaving here this afternoon, leaving a smear from the name of each and every one of them. You shouldn't do that, Mr. Symington. That's just dishonest.
His four-year crusade against communists is over. He had attacked the most sacred institution in America, the United States Army, and lost. The emperor was stripped of his crown and scepter. Joe screamed and yelled and flailed his arms, but to no avail. Nobody listened anymore. For the next 2 years, following that seismic speech in Wheeling, McCarthy launched a full-scale offensive against the beleaguered administration of Harry Truman and the Democratic Party.
The hard fact is that those who wear the label Democrat wear it with the stain of a historic betrayal. The Democrat Party has time after time and irrevocably labeled itself as the party which stands for government of, by, and for communist crooks and cronies.
Those are sections of the program clipped together by Dido. It goes on and on if anybody likes to hear more of Joe. We have some limitations with the program. Most important that we're limited to what's in the archives. If there's a lot of tape material, then we can splice it all together and make it sound interesting. If there's no material, we're stuck. In 1943, we have no mention and no archival material on the coal miners' strike, the confrontation between Harry Truman and John Lewis. So our version of 1943 sounds as if the coal miners' strike never happened. Instead, there's a lot of landings in Italy by the Allies. Sometimes we go away from our own archives. We've had occasion to use BBC archival material, although not frequently. They tend to be a little stiffer about how you get into the archives and how many pieces of paper you have to fill out and how many weeks in advance you have to make your appointment. And they think we're a little crazy sometimes when we phone up and say, can you get me everything you have on John Perfumo by tomorrow? And of course, the other limitation we deal with is that some material is misfiled or is attributed to the wrong dates, or there are errors that just once perpetrated tend to become perpetuated. We didn't know until recently that all those... The other limitation we deal with is that some material is misfiled or is attributed to the wrong dates, or there are errors that just once perpetrated tend to become perpetuated. We didn't know until recently that all those stirring wartime speeches by Winston Churchill were not made by Winston Churchill at all, because there was no recording in the British House of Commons, and there was no recording in most of the places that he spoke. Instead, a very good and earnest and hard-working actor named Norman Shelley sat down from the scripts in a BBC studio and read all the speeches. And here, I don't know how many years and how many Winston Churchill speeches we've been broadcasting is the real thing. We get a good reaction to these programs, particularly if we broadcast material from the 40s during World War II. We always get someone calling up to say, I was there, or my dad was there. Or if we make a mistake, I didn't know that General George Marshall's middle name was Catlett, not Carlett. Or was it Carlett and not Catlett? We called him by the wrong name once. And it reinforces what is for us the good fortune of having those archives down the street from us, where if we phone and make impossible requests, they will try to film them. We don't approach these programs with an archivist's fine sense of preserving history and preserving context and being scrupulously accurate. As someone mentioned, the Singing Nun had two records, not one. Well, we only knew about one at the time. And we also put some of the McCarthy material in from other years to punctuate the points. We take a layman's approach to the archives, and we consider it this grand toy that we can get in there and play with. And fortunately for us, they let us do that, and the listeners let us get away with it. I think if there are any questions, I won't bore you with the details of how we actually put these things together.
Radio you use Friday night and then during the week.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a short question. Do you draw those from the CBC sound archives?
We have drawn some, but more often than not, they come from individual collectors. One guy's got all the Philip Marlowe's, another guy's got all the Batman and Robins.
Right.
And whatnot. We're,
they were never on radio, by the way. Batman and Robin.
No. We have tried to do that, but there's an awful problem with copyright clearance.
That's what I'm thinking, but they're not in the CBC sound catalog yet.
No,
service,
no.
Right?
No, we negotiate on and off to put them in, but the problem, as it was explained to us the first time we tried, was that while all the material in the archives is cleared for broadcast by us, it's not necessarily all cleared for rebroadcast in some cases specific parts of the world. So that in order to, say, distribute 1963, we have to get all the music clearance, all the actuality clearance, if anybody owns subsidiary rights that we may or may not know about. And we, at some point, just flung up our hands in horror and said,
if it's an outstanding radio show.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you like it.
It's tremendous. We have nothing like it in the United States.
Where do you hear us?
From Buffalo, New York.
Ah, you're good. You get a good signal there.
Every night. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
I suppose everybody that has anything to do with radio has their own program in mind to do someday, of which a very small percentage actually happen. Of course, I have a writing script for a pilot series myself, and of course it involves the use of historic recordings. Anything from within the period when recordings were made. And I'm not, I realize I haven't gone so far as to figure out what the complications are in actually airing some of this material. I'm in Christian radio, so it'll have a religious purpose and point. But I will use archival material of all kinds of commercial records. And what sort of problems am I going to have to face? Clearances and so forth. What is? Am I being ridiculous in even trying to think of doing such a thing, or is it possible?
It depends on which archives you deal with. We're very fortunate in that our material in our archives.
Well, I'm talking about Victor Records, Columbia Records, whatever.
Get yourself a big pad of paper, and you have to find the copyright owners and deal with them individually, and hope you can strike the same bargain with everyone. We found ourselves, as an example, caught in a curious bind with the BBC recently. We broadcast a number of BBC transcriptions, and everything was going on well and good. They're cleared for copyright in Canada. One day we got a note from the BBC people in Canada saying, you can't broadcast these things anymore because our shortwave service broadcasts into Britain, and their transcription service was prohibited, or wasn't a matter of prohibition. They just did not have clearance for Britain. And we had been merrily playing these things for some weeks and months, and it so happened that Tony Hancock's estate fired off a letter on their solicitor's letterhead saying either pay up a lot of money or cease and desist. As a result, we can't use that anymore. We don't have a lot of experience with that because we trust that our archival people have taken it. Perhaps Dido knows more about clearances than I do.
How about the person who hears all day Big Band era? Now, do they go clear every one of those records?
Yeah. Yes.
Could I just make a point of clarification here? I'm speaking on behalf of the disc recordings of the CBC. And as an elaboration of the point that you brought up and the question you asked, whether these archival material would ever appear in the Canadian collection or recordings, I think here we have a typical example of the distinction that must be made between a broadcasting organization and a recording organization. And from the end user standpoint, of course, that distinction is very blurred and sometimes isn't even taken into consideration at all. But there is a tremendous distinction. And basically, it's an economic one in the sense that the original broadcasts were contracted for, both by the writers of the material and the performers, for a single occasion broadcast. And it stands at that unless the item is so of such a significant nature that in future it may be possible to find a budget to make the justifiable demands that could be made from the creators, the original creators. I'm not speaking of the producers here, but the original participants of the program, you see, so that a contract is established which permits multi-use, as opposed to the broadcast concept of single occasion use. So that's just a bit of a clarification on this point.
Thanks, Dirk.
I'll just add a word on this. I've been involved on a variety of committees with the Public Archives discussing this whole copyright question related to broadcasting. And in Canada, white proposals for a new copyright act are expected this within the next couple of months, which will be then they'll be kicked around and it'll be take some time to get actually a new legislation. But one of the things that's being looked at very seriously is the definition and inclusion of broadcasting somehow in the Copyright Act, and so that it, as it now stands, since the Canadian Act hasn't been substantially rewritten since 1927, it's very, you know, your distinction is quite correct, and it's very clear for something that was published and that you could have gone out and bought, but it's very unclear for broadcasts. Right.
Yeah, that was one thing I was going to bring up. Now, Don, were you referring to playing phonograph records or... Okay, well, playing phone... Well, one thing we have to remember is, and this is difficult since we are here in Canada, is that the copyright laws in the United States and Canada and Great Britain and in other countries are vastly different from each other. For example, back in the 30s, we had restricted use notices on our sleeves and on the records. Those turned out to be invalidated by American courts in the Fred Waring and Paul Whiteman cases in 38 and 1940. And it went so far that several state courts in several federal jurisdictions said that once a record company sells a record, they have no right to enjoin any use of it. In other words, several state courts declared that pirating of records was legal in the late 1930s and early 1940s in those jurisdictions in the United States. So we've gotten ourselves into some very complicated problems. But under the American laws, if you have a phonograph record, you can broadcast that record as long as you pay the royalty rights, the statutory royalties for the composer and the publisher. The recording artist and the record company gets nothing. Only the composer and the publisher. So you, at least in the United States, you would not have to do any copyright clearances. Now in Great Britain, they've got copyright control. And all the records have not only copyright to against pirating and counterfeiting, but also against broadcasting. The unauthorized use or broadcasting of this record is prohibitive. It's still around the LP labels in Great Britain. Does mean something, at least in Great Britain, not necessarily in the United States. One thing I wanted to ask you, though, I hope that clarifies Donald's questions a little bit. One thing I wanted to ask, though, have you made use of some of the commercially produced documentary recordings? Someone had mentioned that we have nothing like this in the United States. Well, since the mid-1960s, the Associated Press and United Press International have almost every year done a retrospective album. NBC did three of them in 63, 4, and 5 that were issued on RCA Victor. 66 and 67 were done by UPI and were published by American Decca. Have you or can you make use of some of those to fill in on gaps that you might have?
Yes, we have all of those on file. What we generally, very often we have the material that's in them. The way we find them most useful, I'm not sure if I should admit this, is that it's all beautifully edited and we just lift out the actuality and don't tell anyone and send it off, as long as we don't get the narrative bridge that's...
You disclose the state secret.
But yes, we have all those on file, both from the United States and the BBC does the same thing. And we hope to do it too soon.
This is not really a technical question, but while I have the CBC's ear, I'm a great admirer of these retrospectives. But one thing I must say as a musician I resent, while your political items and sometimes your scientific items are on what you might call a very sophisticated level, as soon as you play the music, the sound of 1954, the sound of 1963, you assume, or you have an obsession with a hit parade, with mass culture. Now, the audience that you have is pretty sophisticated, and I'm sure half of them know very little about pop culture, at least pop music. So I would really love it if in 1963 you could play some Stravinsky or some John Cage, because to me that is the sound of 1963. I can tell you, 1963, I never listened to the hit parade. I have no idea who was on, unless I couldn't help to escape it. But I may sound like a snob, but you know, it just isn't the equivalent of what you do in politics and science and your other subjects. So I hope you could also bring in a little bit of the other kind of music. I don't imagine you have any copyright problems.
No, the lack of things like John Cage is strictly a function of our own lack right. Of wherewithal yeah. in saying, aha, we should play that. And right. It's a point well taken. We'll see what we can find. Okay.
I don't know whether Les Waffen came back in or not. Is he inside? Because he was... Oh, because this being VE Day, a couple of years ago in Washington, he did two programs at two different times. One for V... Oh, no, what was it? That was VJ Day, and the other was a landing on June 6th. What was that, D-Day? Yeah. Landing on June 6, 1944. And I was wondering whether he could tell us, or tell the audience here, something about his problems in putting those together, because they were all-day sessions, as I recall. Because I remember using a 3,600-foot roll at 1 7/8 zips, etc. I did have a more serious question. In trying to get clearances for some of these things, does anyone ever ask you to play Winston Smith and kind of change history around and do things like that? Or have you ever been refused because what they had to say 20, 30, 15 years ago perhaps was a little embarrassing to them?
No, we don't encounter that problem with the archival material, because if it's there, it's there. And if it's in the archives, it's available to us. What we have encountered, and the MacArthur hearings use as an example, we added to that program some contemporary recollections from MacArthur's assistant of the time, Roy Cohn, who's an attorney in New York, and another senator who didn't get along with Joe too well. Yes, Senator St. Clair. And it's interesting to witness the revision that they put on events of 20 and 30 years ago. But we've never been out and out refused. No one's ever said, no, I won't talk about that. But then maybe we just haven't asked the right people about the right things.
Is the CBC archival material available to scholars, and if so, under what conditions?
Yes, it is. I'm hesitating because we are so short of staff for the volume of work that we have to do, that basically what we do is confine it to postgraduate students working on their thesis, or at any rate, very, very serious researchers. If I had my way, and if we had the budget for it, I would just love to have it completely open to the public. And I would certainly want to introduce it to students at the elementary school level, because history comes so very much alive. And I would reverse the whole procedure if it was up to me. I would let the university students go where they want, and I would let the public school kids have a go at it. However, we haven't got the budget at the moment to do that, and a lot of people find us very churlish when they ring up. Usually it's because we're being pressured to meet deadlines to go to where. But we do when we can. Okay?
Okay, I think we're approaching here. Do you have another question, Mike?
Now, I do realize that you have mentioned that sometimes there's a shortage of Canadiana in the archive. I have a question as to whether the excerpts that you've played for us today, whether you pick those particular excerpts because of the orientation of the events to the United States, or if that really is what the programs are mostly about. I know that you Canadians are very mindful of the fact that you should be a little bit more than just another colony of the United States, and you have your own culture. I would assume that the program would be headlined with a Canadian event, and with some of the Canadian hits that were not United States hits, rather than being headlined with a United States event. I'm not saying American, I'm saying United States.
Well, I confess, we did select those things partly to play to a largely American audience, material that you would be familiar with in a perhaps a slightly different format than you may have heard it in the past. But generally, I picked Army McCarthy because that was on a couple of weeks ago. We rebroadcast it and had a good response. And it was at hand as a special event. And I chose 1963 because it was one that I produced myself and had some familiarity with. I knew what was there. I didn't have to listen to the whole thing to find the highlights. In 1963, there follows a long piece on the federal election held in Canada that year. And I forget what else. I don't remember the whole lineup. We tend, with those things, to do the same thing we do in our everyday program, which is go for the most exciting or dramatic or important event or story off the top, regardless of where it comes from. And in the case of 1963, the test ban treaty and the talkback between the two astronauts was chosen as the number one. Of course, if you get up to 1967, we have our centennial, or 1968, the Liberal conventions. 67 was also the day or the year that they ousted John Diefenbaker. Those things tend to get played for drama and for pace, without respect to whether there's a maple leaf or stars and stripes tattooed on the backside.
Okay, I think on that note, I'll thank the panelists, and we can proceed to the next session. Thank you. Thank you. I think I was odd.
Thank you very much. I think that was a very interesting session.